First of all, for people who are familiar with the world of acoustic music, they may know your work, particularly starting back in the early days. I assume that you started playing the banjo by playing bluegrass. Is that a correct assumption?
That's right. Earl Scruggs was the clarion call to me, as well as a host of other banjo players. And they heard that sound, that way of playing the banjo, and it just turned them into banjo players.
And yet, that's not where you stayed. You moved on, and I'm familiar with you mostly from your recordings with the Flecktones, and that was quite a ride. How long was that? Were you running the Bella Fleck and the Flecktones unit?
Well, that band started in 1988 with our first show and became full-time in 1990, and pretty much for 25 years was some kind of full-time band, probably the first 20 completely, you know. Mm-hmm. Hard road warrior stuff, and then started to back off as people's lives, you know, as we got older and people started finding their families being important and different things that they wanted to do with their lives too. But we're still in very good contact, and we just did a tour this year for the first time in 3 years, maybe even 4 years, and we're going to get together again next summer. So we love playing with each other, and there's no reason not to keep it alive even as our lives progress into other areas. But in terms of your question about me, and I grew up in New York City. I didn't grow up in the Carolinas or Tennessee or Kentucky, although I moved down here. I'm in Tennessee now, and I was in Kentucky before that. But growing up in New York City and loving the banjo, I was also hearing everything else that was going on in the 60s and early 70s when I was kind of forming as a musical, you know, entity. And that's why I play the way I do. It's because I come from up there, and the match was lit by Earl Scruggs, but I was coming from a different time and a different place.
On a slightly different subject, because this is a classical music show, I have to ask this. Bela Fleck, named after?
Yeah, I've got some serious classical names. Bela Anton Leos Fleck. So for Bartok, Anton Webern, and Leos Janacek. And those were names given to me by my father. And did you ever hear the song by Johnny Cash called A Boy Named Sue?
Yes.
It's kind of like that. So I got all these names, and then he and my mother split up when I was somewhere between 1 and 2 years old, and I didn't meet him again until I was in my 40s. And it's like he gave me those names so I would learn to fight. And it did. And it didn't really work out that way. But no, it is very strange that after all of these years, I've ended up having a classical part of my life. But it really has just as much to do, or even more to do, with my stepfather, who my mother got together with when I was seven. And he was a classical cellist who had been in our armed forces and playing in the symphony in Germany, the American symphony in Germany for the army. And then eventually became a school teacher and worked in Brooklyn as a teacher, as my mother did in New York City. So his influence was stronger than my true father's. But one way or other, still here I am, you know, loving classical music just as much as I love bluegrass.
And you did get a Grammy, I think, for a classical crossover album. Is that true? That was a couple of years back.
Yeah. That's true. It was called Perpetual Motion, and it's called a crossover, I guess, only because I'm not from classical music, but the music was not crossover music. It was straight classical repertoire. It was Paganini, it was Beethoven, it was Debussy, and it was straight transcriptions. It wasn't improvised music or, you know, me jamming around with it. It was and with great classical musicians like Joshua Bell and Edgar Meyer and Evelyn Glennie and others. Yeah, that was a pretty freaky, wonderful thing that happened there where I got to go learn so much about that music and play with these great musicians. And then it also got a lot of attention for the banjo and helped people to see some of the potential for the instrument that is not always seen.
I'm trying to picture Debussy on the banjo. I'd love to hear that. That's a fascinating idea because there's so
it's
much.
Perfect.
Really?
It's rippling. He's a rippler. You know, he's a
yeah.
band rippler. He loves to have those ostinatos and those rippling sounds. And the banjo is great at rippling So the key is finding the right piece.
Right.
And in this case, we found a really nice one, a short one, but a really, really great one that showed off the banjo. A banjo is almost like a little piano in a way. Well, more like that than a guitar to me.
Yes. Well, and before we go to the concerto that you're going to be playing with the South Carolina Philharmonic, let's talk about the banjo a little bit, because you did something. I remember when I read about it, I thought that is so cool that you went to Africa, which is the home of the banjo, pretty much, and you traced its history. You traveled, you met people, you played with people, and a film came out of it.
That's right. That's Throw Down Your Heart. That's the film I made over there. And it was really a very selfish project. Everybody gives me a lot of great kudos for, you know, doing a selfless project. But it was because I wanted to play with these people. I knew that they were great, and I knew that they played all these acoustic kinds of music that I was fascinated by. And I was interested in the history, but I'm not an ethnomusicologist, and I wasn't going to try and make a scholarly project. I just wanted to go play music with people in all these regions and go face to face with some of the people that play the instruments that the banjo is descended from, especially in West Africa. So it was really a wonderful trip, and a lot of very special musical experiences for me came out of it. I think it just again points out that the banjo's has been reduced in a lot of people's minds to this very small percentage of what it truly is. And when you include, you know, the African heritage of the banjo and the way it came to the Americas and became part of the early music here and, you know, predated the guitar and was part of early jazz. A lot of times people forget that the banjo was also in the beginnings of the origins of jazz, Louis Armstrong's music.
Yes.
That there were banjo orchestras that played even like classical music, that ladies played the banjo in their parlors in the big cities. You know, we forget all of this, and we reduce it to the stereotype of you know, the Deliverance movie or Foggy Mountain Breakdown from Bonnie and Clyde, you know, or the Beverly Hillbillies, which all are the white Southern heritage part of the banjo's history, which is a beautiful part of it. But that's not all of it. There's a lot more wonderful things about the banjo.
Well, now, last time you were here in Columbia, you played your first banjo concerto. I have to ask about the title. It's called The Imposter.
That's right. That's me.
I wondered.
Yeah. No, you know, as much of the time as I spend playing music where the banjo isn't usually around, there are times when I feel like I'm going to be kicked out, and someone's going to say, "Hey, what do you think you're doing? This is Chick Corea you're sitting here with. You know, this is Marcus Roberts. This is Branford Marsalis. Who do you think you are? You don't know what you're doing." And I go, "You're right. I don't know what I'm doing. I better get out of here." But since nobody unmasks me, I get to stay there and I get to learn from these people and hopefully get better at all these things. So I felt the ultimate imposter situation would be a banjo player sitting, not only hiding in the orchestra, but actually being the soloist. And somehow got away with it. And you know, of course, we all want to be humble. But the truth is, when you're dealing with composers of the like Mozart and Bach and Beethoven, the bar is so high, you can't possibly wander around thinking you're the greatest. You know, you just do the best you can to be yourself, and hope somebody doesn't call you out on, you know, why you're there in the first place. So that's the imposter, the feeling of being the imposter. Now, that being said, I'm proud of the work, because I think it reflects what I could do at that time, and who I am as a musician, what I'm attracted to, what I love about classical music, and gave me the first shot at it, you know, seeing what I could come up with. I think it's an honest effort. I don't think I tried to imitate anybody, and I've played it now over 50 times. I've got to make another count sometimes. When I got to 50, I stopped counting. So I've had the experience of playing with a lot of different orchestras, and I've puzzled over the things that work. You know, one orchestra plays this part, it's great. Another orchestra plays it, and they go, "Well, that wasn't very written very well," you know. And I go, "Well, you know, but we just played it last week with so-and-so, and it seemed to work there." It's a moving target trying to be a composer and figure out how to be an orchestrator and write something that's going to work in every situation. But all of those experiences of playing it hopefully taught me something, and that's hopefully what I brought into the second concerto, that I would just have naturally picked up a lot from being, because when I wrote the first one, I hadn't really been around orchestras very much at all. It was a very rare experience. Now it's just a regular part of my touring life. I might, you know, go out and do stuff with my wife and go out and do some Flecktones stuff, and then I might go for a weekend and play with an orchestra and play one of the, you know, play one of the concertos. So that's now normal for me. So hopefully I'm better at it because of that exposure and the time to think about how the different things worked in the imposter and things that maybe didn't, that were hard for people, that are always hard for people every time we play them.
Yeah, and for people who don't know, you mentioned playing with your wife, Abigail Washburn, and
yeah.
You guys just won a Grammy this year?
That's right, for a folk album.
Yeah.
Yeah, first time I've ever been in that category. I mean, it's hard to pick. Categories are funny, because why is something folk and why is something Americana and why is something bluegrass and why is something country? The lines between all these things are fluid, and so I mean, I'm glad there was also a tradition, you know, American Roots performance, which we were nominated for, but other people in that category, like Mavis Staples, won that category, and doesn't seem to be that much in common between me and Abigail and Mavis Staples, but then again, maybe there is in a broader roots sort of way, fitting into, you know, American Roots music, you know, is pretty wide as well. But anyway, yeah, that was nice, but making that music with my wife over the last few years has been wonderful because it's kept our family together. It's not only, you know, a commitment to the banjo in a different way, in almost a more old-fashioned way, just two banjo players playing together. My wife's a great traditional player, and I'm a more modernist. But it's kept our family together. We take our little boy on tour with us, and I'm not gone all the time like a lot of musicians. So it's been really good for all in every way. And then to win a Grammy for the record we made in our basement, that was pretty groovy too.
Moving into now what you're going to be playing coming up Saturday here in Columbia, South Carolina, you're going to be playing your second concerto for banjo and orchestra. It's called Juno, and it's named after your son?
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. I played it for my uncle who hadn't heard it up till now last week, and he said, well, that doesn't sound like his personality. And I said, well, I wasn't really naming it for him, I was naming it for me, because it was the impact of being a parent. Mm. As you know, like when I wrote The Imposter, it was just, I was married, but I could still be selfish, and you know, I could even go somewhere for 2 weeks and compose. I could be very, a lot more narcissistic than I can be now. But when you have a child, you know, you're trying to find out, when can I work? Well, I better work when they all go to sleep. Now you're looking for things to do that are meaningful, you know, when Abby and Juno are asleep, and just the change in your person, you know, in your life as a father, and combining that with all of my experiences with the orchestra, and made me want to do a different kind of piece. And it's very hard to put into words how that impacts the music, mm-hmm. but there's a before Juno and there's an after Juno, and this is after Juno, and that's why I decided to name it Juno. I also thought it was a cool sounding name. The Juno Concerto felt like a serious, you know, sounding work. And so, and there it was. There was his name. I mulled over a bunch of possible names, and it seemed like, well, this is the one that describes my life at the time that I was writing this piece.
I appreciate very much what you're saying about fatherhood, the before and after, because I've been there, done that. And it's one of the most life-changing and wonderful things that can happen to a person to become a parent. So now that you can reflect some of who you are in a banjo concerto, and you can say, that's post-Juno. It's really nice to have something like that you'll look back on later on when you're even further down the road with your family.
Well, yeah, and when you're titling a piece, there's a little bit of the imagination coming into it, because a piece that has no words, and yet you're trying to find a hook and a name for it. And I was lucky because finding the imposter as an idea came fairly early as I was writing it. It was in my head, and as I finished writing the piece, I could look back at the music and see that it really did express that feeling of someone from outside sneaking in. And this one, you know, it's just hard to find that big concept, mm-hmm. and I feel like that is what's happening in my life.
Yeah. Well, one last question. And for those
sure.
who are listening who are interested, the South Carolina Philharmonic will be playing Saturday the 12th at the Coger Center in Columbia at 7:30. And the Juno Concerto is going to be on the program along with Aaron Copland's Third Symphony and Leonard Bernstein's Overture to Candide.
Mm-hmm.
Great company.
You know, something else should be said, which is that South Carolina Symphony is one of the commissioners of the Juno Concerto, and I have to thank them so much for believing I could do something worthwhile, for liking The Imposter enough to think I would follow it up with something decent, and stepping up and being part of the impetus to write it. And I appreciate them so much for that.
Well, and let me mention that there were several organizations joining together, the Canton, Ohio, and the Colorado Symphonies, the Louisville Orchestra, as well as the folks at the South Carolina Philharmonic. So all these organizations got together and said, hey, let's do this. And
it's a wonderful thing. It's a real vote of faith in a composer for several orchestras to come together and say, hey, we'd like to be part of you creating the next piece. And it also lets me know that as I create it, I've got four performances for sure, you know, to kick the thing off with. And that gives you some of the impetus that you need to get off your butt and create the thing. It gives you a deadline. It gives you, you know it's going to be meaningful to that extent, you know, right out of the gate. Whatever happens next, only time will tell. But Imposter did get a lot of performances, and I was told when I wrote it not to expect anything after the premiere, and I was like, wow, that's a lot of work to do on a piece you only play once. So luckily, it did resonate enough and led to this. So once again, I have to thank South Carolina Symphony. And Morihiko, I have to say, he's one of the people I really enjoy doing The Imposter with, so I'm really excited to play with him again.
Well, I have one last question, and it comes to mind because of the nature of a concert hall and a symphony orchestra. And I've sometimes wondered this about having heard a guitar concerto live, but only recordings, how the balance goes between the instruments. I realize, of course, you write with dynamics that keep the banjo in mind, but I guess most people do think about the banjo either with a microphone on it or sitting around a parlor and playing. This is a concert hall, and you have to fill it.
That's right. And I've thought a lot about that. And I've talked to a lot of classical guitarists and seen what they do. And in most cases, the idea that you would hear a guitar in the back of the room over an orchestra is that concept is dead, and they've realized they have to do something, because although those people that came want to hear you play, or they wouldn't have brought you to the play. So they amplify. Now if you're going to amplify, you want to amplify in such a natural way that it doesn't feel amplified. And so one thing that I like to do is I do use the mic, a really nice old-fashioned sounding microphone that's very natural, sounds just like the banjo. But I also don't like it to come from speakers way up in the sky. Instead of having a big PA just to run this one silly little microphone through, we have a couple of small speakers that are on the stage that face out from in front of the banjo, in front of the stage, kind of coming from where the banjo is coming from. So you hear the banjo, even though it's enhanced with, if you turned off the speakers, you would still hear the banjo, but you'd be struggling some of the time. We add just enough, and in a natural way, so that it doesn't change the sonic picture that you get to hear when you go hear an orchestra. So when you hear an orchestra play and you're sitting in the audience, your ears are a stereo pickup. They pick up right and left, and there's almost nothing better than a stereo pickup. If you can record something with two mics, it's so cohesive. Your brain can tell you where every instrument is in space. Mm-hmm. It's perfect. So we've striven, if that's the right word, to find a way to fit the banjo into that, knowing that we do need to amplify it in the most natural way that we can, so that you will hear it. The only other way to do it would have been to alternate, like the whole piece where the orchestra played, got quiet, I played by myself, then the orchestra played, and so forth. And you do hear concertos like that.
Right.
But in a way, it's kind of boring to always have to, alternate. And you miss out on a lot of the great possibilities of blending the different instruments together. So that's what I've done. I did my best in the writing to create the space for the banjo, and then slightly amplify it.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for taking some time to join us today and talk about this, your new concerto. That's Bela Fleck, the composer and the performer of the Juno Concerto, coming up on Saturday night, the 12th at 7:30 in Columbia at the Coger Center with the South Carolina Philharmonic.